This is Frieda Worden, and my guest today is Anthony J. Hall. He's the founding coordinator and an associate professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. And he's in Vancouver, to give a talk at SFU and make other appearances, including UBC. And he's promoting his new book called The American Empire and the Fourth World, The Bowl with One Spoon, Part One. And that's by Anthony J. Hall. Professor Hall, why did you call this book The Bowl with One Spoon?
Well, this is volume one of a larger project. The larger project is The Bowl with One Spoon. And The Bowl with One Spoon is a pictograph on wampum. Wampum belts were used among indigenous peoples in North America to formalize treaties. And the French used it, the Dutch used it, the English used it, the Americans used it, the British used it. It was a very important part of the diplomatic protocol in the early days of colonization of North America, as well as prior to 1492, when indigenous people were making treaties among themselves. So the bowl with one spoon is an image of shared hunting territory. And so if you're making a treaty, say it's the Mi'kmaq and the Mohawks, and there's some agreement to share an area in common, that would be the bowl with one spoon. That's what it meant. Now, in the time of Tecumseh, when the Indian Confederacy in the North American interior rose up to oppose the Western expansion of the United States, Tecumseh's vision was that all the Indian nations had to create a confederacy, had to join together, because the United States was picking off Indian people. It was doing divide and conquer. It was saying, you know, we'll deal with the Miami here, the Kickapoo there, the Potawatomi there. So the vision was, no, if we're going to get recognition in international law as sovereign entity, we have to join together. We have to acknowledge all the land is shared together. And of course, it wasn't that long before Tecumseh's life, and he came to prominence in the early 19th century, that the 13 fires, that the 13 colonies that became the original basis of the United States, they had joined together. They were, after all, a rebel movement, a revolutionary movement. If they hadn't succeeded, I guess they would be terrorists, because they took up arms to oppose the dominant authority of those days and the duly constituted government, which was the British Empire, the British government. We are talking about British North America. So Tecumseh's picture was that all the land should be shared together. Thus, the image of the bowl with one spoon took on this larger historical meaning. It was a symbol of essentially opposing the Western expansion of the United States. And, of course, you know, it wasn't only Indians who opposed that Western expansion. It was French Canadians. It was British imperialists. And they came together and formed a polity known as Canada. And so that's why, you know, Canada is a distinct entity to this day. It was largely because of this Indian Confederacy, which fought the United States. This was the most serious challenge to the westward expansion of the United States in its entire history. And the War of 1812, which was between Great Britain and United States, was also had within it this idea of kind of a revolutionary movement within Indian country to create a sovereign Indian country. And the British government actually backed that idea. The British government would have liked to have seen a sovereign Indiana, just like the French backed the American rebels to create the United States. A counter to this was to create a buffer state between British North America and the United States. That would have been Aboriginal Indiana. So this is history that, for me, it resonates. We see this history being reenacted in different ways.
Now, I mentioned to you a little while ago that I had been at the Anthropology Museum at UBC and had seen this statement from King George about Indian lands. And there seemed to be quite a bit of controversy about the interpretation of that and so forth. And when I mentioned this, you said that this had something to do with, let me just ask you to comment on that.
I'm quite sure you were referring to something called the Royal Proclamation of 1763. And I'm arguing that the Royal Proclamation of 1763 is a major document of huge contemporary importance. It's a recognition that indigenous peoples have title to land, have the right of self-government. So it comes following the Seven Years' War between France and Great Britain. And, of course, Great Britain dominate and conquer the French on the Plains of Abraham, and so Canada becomes part of British North America. But then the question is, how do you incorporate Canada, which was by far dominated by indigenous people, by native people? So in the Royal Proclamation, King George reserved the interior of North America as an Indian hunting ground, and he said that if there's going to be any Western expansion, there have to be treaty negotiations with First Nations. He acknowledges indigenous peoples as having some kind of rights. And in some circles in the Anglo-American colonies, this was seen as disastrous, especially, you know, among land speculators, among frontier farmers. So I'm seeing the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, is the founding document of the United States, is in large measure a reaction, a response to the Royal Proclamation of 1763. And Thomas Jefferson, who is the major force, the major draftsperson of the Declaration of Independence, you know, he prior to the Declaration of Independence, he makes it very clear that he's an opponent of the ideas of the Royal Proclamation. He puts out an idea of sort of native title for settlers, and he draws on John Locke and has this whole theory of the settlers as sort of the free Saxons who were oppressed by the Norman conquest. And he reads all of this history into North America. The outcome of it is that in the Declaration of Independence, you of course, this is the famous document where you have the affirmation of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, the equality of all men. They do say men. But if you read further in the Declaration of Independence, most of the document is an indictment of King George, describing all the things that King George is alleged to have done that justify this revolt against his authority. And the last item in this list, and I'm quoting directly now from the Declaration of Independence, the most famous political manifesto of human history in some ways, King George is condemned for bringing on, quote, the merciless Indian savages whose known means of warfare is indiscriminate destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I'm seeing in this provision of the Declaration of Independence a prelude of the War on Terror. I mean, the United States from the beginning, you know, it starts with these bold pronouncements of human rights, and the founders of the United States, you know, are embodiments and carrying some of the very powerful ideas of the Enlightenment period. But of course, you know, they're not consistent. They speak of the equality of men, but then they incorporate slavery in and it took 100 years to deal with that. And they also refer the founders of the United States to the merciless Indian savages, who are essentially terrorists, who are criminalized from the very inception of the United States. So here you have this idea that anybody standing in the way of the Western expansion of the United States is criminalized. There's no right of self-defense, you know, let alone a right of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So this document that you described, the Royal Proclamation of 1763, I see this as, you know, of immense importance. I don't think it's been acknowledged in American historiography or even British historiography how significant this is, because, of course, you know, King George was making his own power move and sort of siding with the Indians, with the Montreal fur trade, with the French Canadians of Quebec. You know, this was definitely a power move on his side. But in the process, he was envisaging a kind of multicultural, pluralistic polity, you know, that would incorporate Indians, French Canadians, Catholics. You know, it's a very different vision than the kind of melting pot idea of citizenship that came in the United States, the kind of tyranny of the majority.
When you talk about the melting pot, I happened to see a lecture on television a year or so ago that was about the Cherokee and their attempts to assimilate to the culture of the colonists, the British colonists. And then at the point at which they thought they were assimilated, they were run out. So they didn't really have that option. And so I guess what I'm saying is multiculturalism was really rejected in the United States. But what about in Canada? What really happened?
Well, I'll cover that history, which I do cover in The American Empire in the Fourth World. So, the Cherokee were a very multicultural society. A lot of Scots Highlanders married into the Cherokee, and they became Christian. They became very successful farmers. Some of them became slave owners. They had a newspaper. This is while they're in their traditional territories in what's now the American Southeast. And of course, Georgia, their conflict with Georgia became, very famous and the subject of major litigation and led to the Trail of Tears, to which you're referring when you say they were run out. They were pushed, west of the Mississippi. So, here's another, to take the story farther forward. From 1776, you have the Indians referred to as merciless Indian savages. I see this as a kind of racial profiling. You're guilty just by virtue of being Indian. You're a merciless savage, and you're so violent, you're so subject to outbursts of anarchy that you there's going to be no law for you. So from the inception of the United States, no, they're not going to accept the ethos of and the laws of the Royal Proclamation. They're going to push westward, and no Indian person is going to have a right to defend their territory. After they create their government, however, and they're successful in their revolt, and Great Britain acknowledges the sovereignty of the United States in the Treaty of Paris in 1783, then they kind of recant and develop a theory of Indian rights and Indian title, and begin to make treaties with the indigenous peoples. And in a way, accept the Royal Proclamation of 1763 in that it centralized power over Western expansion. So, you had this question, would the United States be 13 sovereign states, or would it create a central government, a strong central government that and essentially enabled the United States to become kind of like an empire? Washington becomes, a center of huge power. So it was decided that the central government would take over responsibility for conducting war or conducting treaties with Indian peoples. And among the Indian peoples that were dealt with were the Cherokee. And the Cherokee, had followed the rules in a sense. I mean, they had accepted the idea that, okay, we will adapt to the newcomers' ways. We'll marry them. We'll respect those Scotsmen who want to be Cherokee. And, many Tories, actually, in the time of the American Revolution, they found some kind of refuge with the Cherokee, and some of them became Cherokee. So here you had this kind of thriving multicultural society. But then the government of Georgia couldn't tolerate the idea of an Indian polity on their border taking land which they thought was legitimately part of Georgia. And, of course, the Cherokee had their own constitution, and they had their own parliament and legislature. They had their own institutions. So it came to a court battle. And John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, in Worcester versus Georgia, the famous case Worcester versus Georgia, said, Georgia has no jurisdiction. There are treaties with the Cherokee people, and these treaties are preeminent. It says in the U.S. Constitution that treaties trump any other kind of law. And yet Andrew Jackson just violated the authority of the Supreme Court, the authority of the U.S. Constitution, and used the federal army to displace the Cherokee. So the displacement of the Cherokee wasn't only a violation of the Cherokee, it was a violation of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. It was a violation of treaties. And you had people saying, if the United States does this, violates its own laws, violates its own heritage of treaty relationships with the treaty and other indigenous peoples, this will be a black mark on us, will carry this stain. What other nation will treat the United States as having any credibility if they say they're going to make a treaty, if they can't even keep their treaties internally that they made with indigenous peoples?
It certainly has resonance today. It's still happening.
Yeah, well, I it's very, very serious because, you know, the United States is increasingly viewed with consternation all over the world, especially with the regime of George W. Bush, as a kind of lawless rogue out of control. You know, those 10 million people who gathered a year ago on February the 15th, 2003, to protest the idea of the U.S. invading Iraq without the sanction of the United Nations, as I saw it, you know, the real question is, you know, which is going to be the central body of global governance? Is it going to be the United Nations, which is, you know, has problems and isn't a perfect democracy by any stretch of the imagination? But you know, it's all we have in terms of some kind of global parliament. So the United States, in a sense, is saying, no, we're not going to respect the authority of the United Nations. Our power trumps, is above the authority of the United Nations. We essentially are the law. We're not governed by any other law other than our own domestic political whims. And, you know, this is very dangerous given the amount of weapons of mass destruction and military power that one country has amassed. So I'm arguing in this book, The American Empire and the Fourth World, and I start it with a discussion of Iraq and the invasion of Iraq, that the way the United States is acting now, actually, you can see the shaping of this approach in the Western expansion. You can see, you know, from the Declaration of Independence, this initial idea that we're going to have universal laws and life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, but we retain the power to exclude whoever we want. And, you know, I jump right forward from the Declaration of Independence, jump right forward to Guantanamo Bay and, you know, the people detained. What do they call them? Illegal combatants. You know, the U.S. Invented this word. It has no other background, but the idea of Guantanamo Bay is they don't have access, the prisoners, to domestic law. There's no due process in domestic law, and they have no access to international law, you know, to prisoner of war status. So they have no rights, they have no human identity. They're outside all the framework of international law, of domestic law. But this is not a new thing. Geronimo, who was, you know, the most famous resistor in the Western expansion of the United States, he was at it right up to the 1880s, and, you know, eventually he was incarcerated. They could never say, well, what is he? Is he a criminal? Is he a domestic criminal who broke the criminal laws of the United States, or is he an international criminal? Is he a freedom fighter? I mean, this is what we're lacking, you know, in this discussion on the war on terror, or the lack of a real discussion on the war on terror. Well, what does that mean? You know, who gets to say? Who is going to determine who is a terrorist? I mean, do terrorists just come out of their mother's wombs? You know, can you just decide somebody has the possibility of becoming a quote-unquote terrorist? I mean, these issues go back into the history of Western expansion. The U.S. Army, the military-industrial complex of the United States, where did it start? It started in Indian Wars. It started, you know, fighting Tecumseh. It started opposing the principles of the bowl with one spoon. So, you know, in order to resist, indigenous peoples said, well, we've got to come up with some kind of confederacy, some kind of unity. And that was what drove Tecumseh. And that principle was at issue in the War of 1812. I see the War of 1812 as a kind of Indian version of the American Revolution. You know, they were trying to create some kind of sovereign polity out of that.
What was the outcome? I mean, it looks as we still don't have in this hemisphere any kind of a sovereign polity of indigenous people, do we? I mean, maybe.
Well, you mentioned the Cherokee. So the Cherokee eventually were forced out of their territory, their Aboriginal territory, which was, you know, acknowledged in all kinds of treaties, and they were marched out at gunpoint. And in fact, there was a policy in the United States that all Native people east of the Mississippi must go west of the Mississippi. And so, you know, here's your ethnic cleansing, here's your apartheid. I mean, it's in a way that was the most sweeping image or vision of apartheid that you could imagine. And it was Andrew Jackson who pushed this forward. So then the idea was Indian Territory, which is now Oklahoma. Indian Territory would be the place where there would be some kind of sovereign acknowledgement of Indian sovereignty. And so the Cherokee and others, they called them the Five Civilized Tribes. And I've heard people from that group say, well, they had slaves, so they must have been civilized. So the Cherokee, you know, had their own slaves and the Chickasaw and Choctaw. So they went to Indian Territory and then reestablished legislatures and their own institutions, their own laws. So up until 1907, when Oklahoma was created, Indian Territory was to be the part of North America where there was some kind of recognition of Indian government, of the capacity of indigenous peoples to develop their own institutions based on their own laws, based on their own economics. But of course, some of the Cherokee became entrepreneurs and land speculators themselves, and you know, invested in railways and became, you know, members of the boards and railways. There was even a Chickasaw Railway Company. So the deeper they got involved in the sort of capitalist system of the United States, this broke them up. So you know, this is where the bowl with one spoon comes in. You know, once you start to say, well, there can be free trade in lands and resources, this violates the capacity of groups of people to maintain their group identity and maintain their own laws. If I can jump forward, and that's what I do in this book, I try to make these big jumps. But you know, following the Second World War, the empires of Europe were dismantled. And supposedly there was an era of decolonization. You know, when Africa, these colonies became independent, Asia, you know, the Vietnam was a French colony, and the United States was afraid that it would fall to communism, so they intervened in Vietnam. It was all part of this process of decolonization. But decolonization got caught up in the Cold War. And you had some of these leaders of the decolonization movement, Sukarno, for instance, in Indonesia, or Nasser in Egypt. You had leaders of this movement saying, essentially, we want to develop our own resources locally for our own benefit, and we want to maintain some sort of ability to make laws for our own people when it comes to do with our economics and how we're going to relate to our, you know, our oil, our forests, our water power. The non-aligned movement was treated by the U.S. government as, well, these are communists, so it's okay to kill them. To, you know, there was a million people killed in Indonesia when Suharto replaced Sukarno, and you know, this was all done with U.S. backing. You know, the Cold War sort of reenacted many of these patterns where indigenous people were seeking some kind of ability to develop indigenous sovereign movements. And that was perceived to be communism. That was perceived to be subversive by the United States. You know, Allende in Chile, Masada in Iran. You know, the list just goes on and on of leaders of this decolonization movement who were taken out by the United States, were assassinated, or sometimes, you know, you could discredit them professionally, or you know, this reenacts patterns that happened in the earlier phase of the colonization of Western North America.
Wow. Let's take a short break for me to re-identify you and your book, because people are probably wondering, what's he talking about? Yeah. So, again, my guest is Anthony J. Hall, who is the founding coordinator and associate professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge, and has just come out with a nice fat book called The American Empire and the Fourth World, The Bowl with One Spoon, Part 1. And as we were saying earlier, in case you've just tuned in, the bowl with one spoon was the symbol on the wampum that was what was used to seal treaty agreements in the between tribes of indigenous people in North America, and then later between them and the colonists, who proved not to be such good treaty keepers. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself at this point. How is it that you embarked upon the study, and the very intensive and detailed study, of this movement, or this, I don't know, it's more than a movement, it's a whole pattern in North America, but I can tell you that from what I've seen, that this is the same pattern that's repeated all over the world, and you were just mentioning some of the other countries where we see it. So, but how did you get started on this study?
Well, I have a PhD in Canadian history from University of Toronto, and in 1982 I began teaching Native Studies at Laurentian University. So from 1982 to 2002, I've been a professor of Native Studies, or as we call it at the University of Lethbridge, Native American Studies. And so, you know, I've been studying for a long time and did my thesis on the colonization of indigenous peoples, first in Canada, or what, or the polities that the older polities. Actually, there is a Canada before there's a United States. Canada is the sort of first level of it's the outcome of the fur trade between the French and the Aboriginal people, and they give rise to a new jurisdiction called Canada. Looking at indigenous peoples and the process of colonization, more and more I thought, well, it's certainly you've got to look at it throughout North America. You can't just exclude it to Canada, as if you're going to be true to the idea of looking at indigenous peoples in their own right. You know, these borders, for instance, the 49th parallel, that's an imposed border. It's not a natural border with any meaning to the indigenous peoples or the older polities. And then you start to think, okay, that imposed border, how's that different than the imposed borders on Africa? You know, the Indian Act, which created the idea that Indian people are wards of the government in Canada, and there was a similar thing in the United States. Well, all of Africa was treated that way in the late 19th century. The indigenous Africans had their territories cut up and carved up, and they had no say. This was imperialism. This is European imperialism in action. So this book reflects, you know, years of thinking about the larger patterns. And of course, you know, when I saw the war on all the controversy about would the United States go into Iraq, and hear the type of rhetoric accompanying the war on terror, you know, hear George Bush talk about the war on terror almost like some kind of holy jihad, which God is sort of manifesting his will that the United States express some kind of shining beacon on the hill and lead you know, the world into perfect freedom and democracy. I mean, this is old. This pattern goes way, way back, and it's been used. You know, it's the type of rationale that was used to justify the taking of Indian land. You mentioned, you know, we've mentioned the Royal Proclamation of 1763, and how do you tie all of these things together? I mean, you should be aware, and many of your listeners will be aware, that British Columbia has the most complex series of treaties being negotiated right now. And all of this goes back to the Royal Proclamation of 1763. All of this goes back to the history, you know, prior to the American Revolution. So when British Columbia was formed as a new jurisdiction in the British Empire in 1858, indigenous peoples said at the time, okay, now you've got to make treaties with us. They did make a small number of treaties in establishing, you know, Vancouver Island as the first sort of colonial outpost. It got a status slightly different than the rest of the Hudson's Bay Company lands as early as 1849, and they made some treaties in the Victoria area. But then came the gold rush and the influx of Californians into the territory here, and the British government acted very quickly and said, oh, well, we've got to create we've got to clarify that this is British territory and think about, you know, calling it British Columbia. You know, Columbus is a kind of, you know, a powerful name. No wonder there's a kind of acrimony with Indigenous peoples in a territory called British Columbia. On the other hand, you know, why aren't they making treaties in California? You know, there was a huge genocide. I mean, California is one of the most superlative examples of ethnic cleansing. You know, Indian people are just wiped out in California. It wasn't quite the same in British Columbia. So right from the inception of British Columbia, there was this controversy. And essentially the British government was trying to get out of the business of paying for its colonies. It was kind of decentralizing itself. It was an era of free trade liberalism. And the idea was, well, we'll give you control of the land, local legislature, and we'll give you quite a bit of latitude to govern yourselves locally. But you've got to pay the Indians for the land. You've got to make the treaty. You've got to live up to the terms of the Royal Proclamation. And the Royal Proclamation said, you know, if any of the said Indians should be inclined to dispose of their land, the same shall be purchased for us, said King George, at some public meeting to be declared for the purpose. Among the missionaries that came into British Columbia were Anglican Church of England missionaries. And I think the Church of England missionaries were a Mara comes to mind, William Duncan. You know, they talked about the Royal Proclamation, and there was a lot of education going on among Indigenous peoples. And they had their allies, their Anglican allies and others who encouraged them to say, no, you know, you're going to be incorporated within the British Empire, but you're not going to be totally dispossessed and oppressed by the British Empire. There's a rule of law. And so this was a controversy in British Columbia since its inception. There were delegations of British Columbia Indian people who went to see the Prime Minister, the Queen. You know, they tried to get a case before the Privy Council of the House of Lords in England. You know, it's quite an interesting history. If you ever get to read Paul Tennant's Aboriginal People and Politics, he lays out this history. So the question of the applicability of the Royal Proclamation of 1763, this is the big question in British Columbia right now. And of course, you know, without the historical background to this, I mean, you have the Alliance Party, you have, you know, the right wing, the people who form the basis of the provincial government right now. I mean, they got into power largely saying, well, we're going to stop this treaty making. We're going to put Indian people in their place, you know, sort of invoked all of this old Indian fighting rhetoric. I mean, which, you know, is a very powerful force in U.S. politics. William Henry Harrison was an Indian fighter. Andrew Jackson was an Indian fighter. You know, they got famous. They got prominent by virtue of beating Indians in Indian wars. So, you know, saying that we're going to put the Indians in their place and prevent them from asserting some kind of title and interest in their territory and some kind of lawmaking authority. I mean, this goes back and back and back to 1492, essentially. So, you know, British Columbia is, I think, in all the world, the place where this question of Aboriginal title is most there's most focus on it. It's most elaborate. There's a lot of jurisprudence on it. No government can sort of get out of it. And you know, but this is not an issue which is unique to this territory. We're talking about the legacy of colonialism. We're talking about the reality that Europeans expanded all over the planet, took over, you know, the lands of Africa, developed, you know, in India was a colony. China was virtually a colony. People in the Middle East, I mean, they feel colonized by the French and English.
Australia, I just wanted to mention, has just recently had big doings around Aboriginal title issues as well.
Yeah, and there's quite a bit of connection between the situation in Australia and British Columbia. And in my web course, I might mention that if you go to www.globalizationstudies.org, you can see archived classes that I do. And one of those classes was with professors in Australia. We're going to do one tomorrow night, and I don't know when this will be saying so.
It'll be tonight when this airs. So just www.
www.globalizationstudies, one word, globalization with a z.org.
Yeah. And this is a video thing, stream that people can watch. At least a limited number of people can watch this. And it'll be a class where you're having a web discussion between your class and a class in Australia?
Well, there's no limit to it. It's on the World Wide Web, so it's like watching television on the World Wide Web. I imagine that you're doing audio streaming, so we just do video streaming. So anybody can come in from 5 to 8 and take part. There'll be a chat line.
Is that 5 to 8 Pacific time, or what time?
Yeah, that's 5 to 8 here. Mm-hmm. And then my class back in Lethbridge, we're in the high-tech classroom, so that will be linked by video conference. So we'll have a number of visitors, and I hope we'll have a good array of interesting folks on campus. I think Wolverine will be there, who was a veteran of the Battle of Gustavson Lake, the Indian War that happened in BC here in 1995. He did heavy duty time in prison. He stood steadfast on his principles. So I'm in Vancouver area. I'll be talking February 25th, which is, who knows, this is being taped, but it's Wednesday, February 25th, 12:30 to 1:30 at Green College at UBC. So, I see this as in a certain sense ground zero of this issue of Aboriginal title, the place on the planet where the ongoing implications of the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which I believe was the major factor that brought about the American Revolution, and the American Revolution, of course, gave rise to the world superpower, the United States of America. So the Royal Proclamation of 1763 is a tremendously influential document. It's so influential that it's deeply affecting the politics of British Columbia to this day, and it's the background to all of the modern day treaty negotiations going on. So I think it's very interesting to be in this jurisdiction and to. And part of what I'm trying to do in the American Empire and Fourth World, I think British Columbia is the most important place in the world in dealing with some of these issues.
Well, can you say what's at stake in this treaty negotiation? And how does this relate to the ongoing threads that you're talking about in your book?
Okay, so in 1763, King George is faced with, how am I going to govern Canada? Canada has been acquired from the French Empire through military conquest. Indigenous people make a stand and say, you may have conquered the French, but you haven't conquered us. Pontiac and his people took over several posts. This causes the British government to reassess its position, and they come up with this Royal Proclamation of 1763. And essentially it says Indigenous peoples can't be unilaterally dispossessed. Indigenous peoples have rights, and if their lands are going to be taken for the purposes of Euro-American settlement, there have to be negotiations. There has to be some kind of prior agreement, and this gives Indigenous people some opportunity to negotiate some kind of new position in the new society to come. So it's not that complicated. The Royal Proclamation, I see, is a basic principle that we should be adopting in international law, that basically you can't just go around and use military power to overwhelm people. Might is not right. We want to have a society where the rule of law is respected. The rule of law means you can't do genocide. You can't do theft. I mean, there's some basic principles which we recognize in our day-to-day morality. Stealing's wrong, murder's wrong. We need to have some kind of regulator to come in to make sure that when these things do take place, there's some sort of accountability. So in British Columbia right now, you've got a society, a province of Canada, that essentially developed outside the rule of law. The Royal Proclamation, which was adhered to in other parts of Canada, in the prairies where I'm from, the number treaties were made in the 1870s. Even the United States made treaties until 1871. Then it just said, no, we don't have to make treaties anymore. We're going to depend upon conquest. And in fact, the United States was asked in the United Nations in 1987, where did you get your title over Indians and over their lands? And they said, through conquest. So surely, you know, one of the big issues we face as humanity is to say conquest is not a legitimate way to assert your sovereignty or jurisdiction. You know, what happened to the Aboriginal title of the people of Iraq? Was it just extinguished? I mean, do they have the capacity to put in place a government that might not be friendly to the United States? I don't think so. The deal is, you know, you can have self-government, but it's going to be limited self-government, and it's got to be people who we find acceptable. And if anybody gets in there who we don't find acceptable, we retain the right to take them out. In any case, this idea that you know, you can't just dispossess people, that you've got to go through some procedure, that you've got to have a due process, you've got to have a rule of law. This is what's at issue in British Columbia. And it's hard for people to accept that this whole jurisdiction is in a way illegal. It grew up outside the rule of law. The treaty process is to bring the province back into the rule of law.
So we go to meetings around Vancouver, and people will start the meeting by saying, you know, I recognize that this is unceded Coast Salish territory or something like that.
I have heard that.
Yeah. So when you're on unceded Coast Salish territory, then what is being proposed, what's on the table to do about the fact that this unceded territory is now occupied by a bunch of public and private buildings that are not operated by Coast Salish?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, isn't it? You know, we've dealt with issues in, say, northern Canada. I mean, the Dene in the 1970s brought their case forward to Tom Berger, who did an inquiry about building a pipeline there. And Canadians, you know, gradually wrap their mind around the idea, well, maybe, you know, we can do development and not just push the Indians totally aside. Now you've got a situation where the Dene actually want to take part in the majority of people in the pipeline construction with their own companies and their own infrastructure of institutions and have a part of in the economy and not to just be marginalized by the kind of development that's going to take place. I mean, that goes back to the Berger inquiries in the mid-1970s. It's one thing to imagine, you know, the Indian territory. It's always somewhere else, right? It's somewhere off in the north, somewhere beyond the mountains. But to think of Vancouver as Indian territory, that's a, you know, it's a very interesting and I think challenging notion. And obviously, the Stalo or Musqueam, the Coastal Salish people, you know, can't imagine having a hunting territory. Although they could, you know, fishing is a subject of great controversy. So there are ways to imagine integrating Aboriginal title, Aboriginal rights into an urban setting. There are ways it could be done, and it speaks of, you know, thinking about the economy in a certain way, that it's not just so many equal individuals slugging each other over the head in a kind of competitive system. And of course, you know, our competitive system, I mean, the system of inheritance and the system of corporate rule, it's not an equal, you know, equal players. You know, there's some players have huge advantages in this system and others who are marginalized by the system. And invariably, it's the indigenous people who are marginalized by the system. So how could you imagine an economy that had some pluralism in it? And this seems to me to be a global challenge. I mean, are we going to picture is the future of the world to be a monoculture, a sort of extension of Southern California? Or can we picture a different kind of future? This is where the fourth world comes in, by the way. George Manuel wrote a book in 1974 called The Fourth World. George Manuel was a shoe swap leader, very visionary Indian leader in British Columbia, went on to become national chief of the National Indian Brotherhood. He wrote this book, The Fourth World, in 1974, and the next year founded an organization called the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. And I think that's still ahead of its time. So, you know, he pictured a world, the fourth world. And this was in response to the idea of the third world, which speaks of kind of underdevelopment. It speaks of the concept of people accepting a vision of themselves as underdeveloped, and then replicating forms of development that happened in other parts of the world, replicating North American or European development. The idea of the fourth world was, no, we reject that notion. We want to go forward. We want to use technology. We want to take advantage of modern things and communication, and but we don't want to give up our Aboriginal heritage. We want to develop in a way that is consistent with our Indigenous roots. And so this is a vision that I think is can be inclusive. As a Canadian nationalist, I think, well, why should I accept an identity for my country, Canada, as a kind of satellite under, you know, the missile defense umbrella of the United States or something? This is a sovereign country. And why can't we have a different kind of society? I think making treaties, for instance, this is something that really marks us as a different kind of society than the United States, which is a kind of lawless society, which does not grow up respecting the rule of law. You know, I mean, the Trail of Tears and all of that speaks to the fact that there is a profound sense in the United States that you don't have to follow the rules, that you do what is politically expedient. You don't have to adhere to the United Nations. You don't have to adhere to the International Criminal Court. You know, you don't have to follow any of the rules. You have a problem and you're going to ultimately solve it by demonstrating that you're the biggest, most powerful kid on the block. We still haven't dealt with the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And to me, you know, here is a perfect moment which displays this U.S. sense that ultimately its force, might is right. Ultimately, the Constitution of the world is the biggest, most powerful forces prevail. I mean, and in a way, that's also the ethos of capitalism, that capitalism is the real, it's dog eat dog, it's Darwinistic. This is what we need to be challenging.
We just have a few minutes left, and there was a question that came up in my mind when you were talking about Thomas Jefferson and about the Saxons and about how the Saxons had been a conquered people in Europe. And I might mention, I just saw a film last night called Signs Out of Time. It was about the archaeologist Maria Gimbutas, who got in a lot of trouble with other archaeologists for saying that there had been a long period of peaceful settlement in old Europe where people didn't even have any weapons and they didn't have representations of weapons, and then conquest sort of changed all that culture. And I'm wondering what you think about the Saxons and you know, why did they come with that? Were they conquered people? I mean, it's kind of like the Israelis too. I mean, is there something that's passing on, and is there any way to reverse it?
Yeah. Well, if you read Thomas Jefferson's, especially his summary of the rights of British North Americans, which he wrote in 1774, so he's referring to himself and his people as British North Americans. This is before the American Revolution. And as I see it, he's responding to the Royal Proclamation of 1763. He's responding to King George's recognition that Indigenous peoples have some sort of rights to their territory and that these have to be negotiated in changing the status quo of British North America. So Jefferson, in the face of this, comes up with this idea that the Saxons, he has a utopian vision, a kind of, this was the golden age when the English were, you know, the British Isles, that part of the world was a Saxon paradise. And the Saxons held their land in sort of freehold tenure, and each individual was a sovereign individual, and they maximized the amount of freedom that they could express. And then along came the nasty Normans and the Norman conquest, and then the Normans imposed this idea of a king and the central authority of a state, and tried to treat land title as an extension of the authority of the crown. So Jefferson says this, you know, he hearkens back to the Free Saxons. He sort of sees himself as a spokesperson for the Free Saxons. So it's kind of interesting that you have this whole discussion essentially on Aboriginal title in North America, where he transposes all his theory about what happened in England into North America in a way trying to discredit the monarchy. And of course, you know, the monarchy is a conservative force. It deals with hereditary titles. Indigenous peoples are the conservative force. You can't fight Aboriginal rights in the name of conservatism. I mean, that's what I find so ludicrous when I hear, you know, Alliance people thinking, well, we're conservatives and we're against the Indigenous people. No, the Indigenous peoples and their ability to hold land and territory, that's obviously a conservative position. And so, you know, there's this natural alliance between the monarchy in Great Britain and the Indigenous peoples. And this is the heritage of my country. This is the heritage of Canada. I mean, Canada emerges from the conservative side of this dispute between liberals and conservatives. The Whigs, the liberals, are the revolutionaries. But isn't it interesting that it's the conservative side that recognizes the rights of Indigenous peoples? It's the conservative side that has a more organic view of a multicultural society that can incorporate different kinds of people and have a sort of range of different laws for different kinds of people, whereas the Republicans, the revolutionaries, they have this kind of monocultural view of the world. And, you know, you can see that in the United States right up to the present day where there's a sense that you've got to adapt. There's one language, one national identity, you've got to adapt. When the Southern Confederacy, you know, tried to assert a kind of distinct identity within that framework, it ultimately came to a civil war. So part of what I feel the American Empire in the Fourth World is about is to kind of claim Canadian conservatism and not take conservatism to be imported from the United States. Republicanism, you know, right-wing Republicanism imported from the United States, which is how I see the Alliance Party, for instance, or Gordon Campbell, and they're importing right-wing Republicanism and calling it conservatism. But in fact, Indigenous conservatism in Canada is a movement that recognizes Aboriginal rights. It has a great amount of interest and vested interest in treaties, that has a vision of a more pluralistic kind of society, multicultural society, more organic between communities that have some ability to be self-defining and self-governing, respects French Canadian language, for instance, from coast to coast to coast, that recognizes Indigenous peoples. We've got this treaty system which goes back and back and back before, you know, the American Revolution. We're trying to show consistency to bring that treaty system into British Columbia, to bring British Columbia into the heritage of Canada rather than have it be an extension of the United States. That's what I see, the current anti-Aboriginal approach in British Columbia, which you hear from the Alliance Party and even the provincial government, is an extension of the United States approach. And the United States approach is to hell with the law. We want to, get the Cherokee out of their territory. Not only do we go against the Cherokee, we go against the Supreme Court. We go against the Constitution of the United States. That lawlessness is what we're trying to cope with globally.
This has been very interesting. My guest today on SFU Ideas and Issues has been Anthony J. Hall, who's a scholar of Canadian history, right? And he's the founding coordinator and associate professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. And he's here in British Columbia speaking to some classes and promoting his new book, The American Empire and the Fourth World, The Bowl with One Spoon, Part 1, which is published by McGill Queen's University Press. This is Frieda Worden. Thank you so much for listening to SFU Ideas and Issues. And I'll just mention one more time the website where you can see archived classes from Anthony J. Hall and his classes. What was that website?
It's www.globalizationstudies.org. And the class on February 25th, I'm here at SFU. I'll be doing the class here, and the class is in Lethbridge, so we'll have a video conference link between SFU and University of Lethbridge. So you'll be able to watch it on this website, or come into the video center and take part.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm inviting you specifically, Frieda, to join us tomorrow.
Thank you. I look forward to it very much. Anthony J. Hall.